to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. Just a reminder here that if you're on a phone and want to dial in and listen to some recent Expanding Mind episodes, you can call 1-701-719-0890. That's 701-719-0890, and get some recent episodes, which are, of course, also available on the PRN archive, as well as my own technosis.com, technosis.com. Always good to do a little self-promotion there. It's always hard for me to do. Just the other day, someone sent me, someone from PRN actually sent me a link to an interview with Paul Kingsnorth, a British writer who wrote a book that got a lot of play called The Wake a couple of years ago. He's an environmentalist, and he's got a book coming out called Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist. And what makes Kingsnorth kind of interesting is that he started this project called the Dark Mountain Project with some other writers and environmentalists, and basically they sort of came to the conclusion that that environmentalist struggles are in the long run hopeless, and that rather than hide away from that fact, to just kind of embrace it and move through it and write from that and act from that. And for Paul, that meant going to Ireland, where land is cheaper, and starting a homestead with his family. And it's a fascinating interview because it's not really as pessimistic as it might sound. It's actually, I won't say exactly hopeful, but it really gets things down to brass tacks. And when I read it, I felt the feeling that I not infrequently feel as a lifelong urban dweller who's been in the same apartment, now rent controlled, has been rent controlled in San Francisco for 20 years, where it would be really a remarkable thing to be living a little bit closer to the land, with a little bit more space around me, a little fewer people, and a lot more critters. I sometimes wonder inside whether I'll ever achieve escape velocity, even temporarily. There's so many things that call me to keep working and keep living my life as I live it. But it's a feeling I think a lot of people feel. Certainly, a lot of people in my generation, a lot of people in my situation, not being so happy with urban living in some ways, a little overwhelmed with modern life, and feeling this kind of call. And whenever I have that feeling, I always think of my pal Jay Babcock, who is our guest today. I first met Jay, 10 years ago or so, when he was editing, or actually earlier, when he was editing the late, great Arthur Magazine, which was the last publication I wrote for that I was truly, absolutely in love with. And it was a very, very urban paper. You could call it hipster if you wanted to. It covered a lot of really interesting crossovers of underground music and spirituality and urban homesteading. And it really helped kind of mint a lot of the memes and practices and ideas that a lot of kind of contemporary, quote unquote, hipsters continue to play out, albeit in generally less interesting ways than were presented in the magazine, which went way, way beyond hipster as well. But in any case, all this to say that Jay was a very urban cat. And then I think around 2010, he pulled up stakes and moved to Joshua Tree, the high desert east of Los Angeles, and where he hooked up with Stephanie Smith, who was an architect who had been working in Los Angeles as well, doing the teacher urban architecture thing, and also pulled up stakes, and they moved to Joshua Tree and started a new life. And I've kept up with Jay off and on over the years. I kind of wanted to bring him on, just talk to him about moving to the desert, about his own version of postmodern homesteading, if you will. So with no further ado, Jay, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you, Eric. I'm really happy to get to talk with you again. How are you?
Yeah, it's super fun.
Good. Well, I'm talking to you from as we say out here, we're on a dirt road. We're on the grid, but we're off the pavement. we've got Netflix and cell phones and so on, but we don't have the post office. We have running water, but we don't have pavement. And it's beautiful. We're having a total gigantic wildflower season out here, and I'm watching turkey vultures spin around in the sky right now.
Do you always have turkey vultures, or do they come and go?
Not always. They migrate from altitude to altitude a couple times a year in groups, and then other times we see solo guys flying around looking for corpses.
As they do. I mean, I can only imagine that one of the great, I mean, when I imagine making that kind of move and really being able to settle into a place rather than just, you know, visit for a weekend or a week or whatever, is really getting into not just, you know, becoming more aware of the non-human critters around you, but starting to get a sense for their own kind of flows, when they come, when they go, when things are vital, when things shut down. You know, that I can only imagine that that's a big part of your experience there.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, for me, even though I visited the desert many times, you know, like you said, it's Joshua Tree is about 2.5 hours from Los Angeles. And I had, you know, there's a national park there. And before it was a park, it was a big national monument. And I had been out camping in the park many times with college friends and college times and post-college times. And then later in the late 90s, early 2000s, I was coming out here in my career as a music journalist, and I was interviewing a bunch of interesting musicians who had sort of headquartered out here from the Queens of the Stone Age camp. And, you know, so I'd visit here, and I'd be here 2 days, 3 days here and there, but it is, as you say, it's very different when you're there and you never leave. And you do start seeing things with more depth, and you see a lot more stuff, of course, because just being there day after day. The first thing is that when I moved here and started living, and Stephanie and I started living together, we didn't meet until we were both living in Joshua Tree, by the way. But we didn't know who were all these critters. You know, like, oh, that's a bird, but what kind of bird? And so the first thing you start doing is you identify the species, you know, of the animal that you're seeing. You know, you start figuring it out, and then you, as you stay there longer, though, you get to know the individual animals, because they do come and go, but a lot of them actually live here, of course, and you see the same one every day, like at the same time, doing the same stuff, and you start knowing which lizard is which. And it sounds kind of a little bit silly, but after a while it becomes pretty profound to think that you're witnessing and experiencing an area with, at the same time as this weird animal consciousness that's, you know, surviving out here heroically in these difficult conditions year in, year out. And they become really interesting, and it definitely, you know, expands your mind and changes the way you think about things.
Well, I've always loved the desert, and I've had the opportunity to spend a decent amount of time in it, although rarely for very long stretches. But one of the reasons I fell in love with deserts is just that. The sense of the fragility, the simultaneous fragility and tenacity of life, and really learning, you know, both with the flora and the fauna about the incredible brilliance that goes into survival in these conditions. And it somehow speaks to something, I don't know, for whatever reason, even though I very much love lush landscapes as well, or, you know, rich green forests, the forests of the Pacific Northwest, et cetera, et cetera. There's something about that, the kind of clarity and tenacity of the desert that really appealed to me. What, was that something that was going on for you? Was it like a particular call to the desert when you were deciding to leave the city environment?
I know what you're saying, and yeah. My life is like this. I lived, in retrospect, in my first 18 years, I lived in the suburbs of the Inland Empire of California. So I was in Riverside, Upland, Claremont areas. The next 20 years, I was at school at UCLA and then lived in Los Angeles. And then I lived in Brooklyn and Philadelphia for like a year and a half. And then it did come time for me to move back to the West Coast, and I didn't want to live in the city anymore. And Joshua Tree made sense for me, not because I knew people here. And I did like it. It was beautiful, and I was intrigued by it. But it was mainly because, you know, I knew people, and there were other areas that were also interesting, but this was the one that was easiest, the one that made sense for me. It definitely, like you're saying, I think one of the things that happens is that life here is very precious, and when you see something come up out of the ground, it's, like I said, it's very heroic and it's very intriguing. And you also, because there's so few plants and animals, I mean, the place is full of life in one sense, but in another sense, it isn't. There's a lot of barrenness and a lot of voidness, a lot of emptiness. And so when something is alive there, you know what it is. You find out what kind of plant it is, what kind of animal it is. And I think when you're in a lush forest, you're kind of, you could be, I mean, different people have different sensibilities, but you could be sort of overwhelmed, and there's like 90,000 kinds of things here. There's fewer, but you know them all. Or if you don't know them, they're a brand new thing to find something out about. And you know, we have one of the great things about being out here in Joshua Tree is that there is the Mojave Desert Land Trust, which is a land trust for the area. They buy up land and they steward it for the good of the land and the creatures on it. And because of that, we have, just as residents here, we have access to the land trust's resources, which includes, you know, scientists and wilderness advocates and so on, who can help us understand the richness of the area that we're in. And that's been really, really important to me also, a really nice attribute of this place that I think some other places wouldn't have. And of course, we're next to a national park, and so you have all the resources of the national park in terms of telling you what could be here, what is here, what's been here before, how it works, and you get it's fantastic if you're tired of human culture, contemporary culture, if you're tired of human manufactured things, if you're fatigued by that sort of thing, then this is a nice waypoint between, you know, total hermithood and like the hyper urban experience, which to me, I prefer at this point in my life, having been through the hyper urban experience and through the suburban experience, this is a more attractive space for me to be in, but it's not for everyone. And I think, and like you said, you know, there are many other places in the planet or even in this state or in this county that offer similar things in a different way that I think would be more healthy for people, maybe perhaps more healthy for people to live in more often. And I think just to expand on a little bit on your point, there's things you can do in the urban areas you can't be done anywhere else, you can't experience anywhere else, and those are valuable. And I don't mean to demean those things at all, but I will say when most people go on, you know, most people who can afford to go on vacations, they go to natural settings. They go to the forest, they go to the water, they go to the ocean, they go to an island. They essentially try to surround themselves with as much nature as they can. And if you think about why is that? Why do they only go there then? Why not go to that natural setting more often? And I found myself, even when I was living in LA, and I didn't get to go on vacations much because I was, you know, hand to mouth. But I did have the LA River, and I had Griffith Park within walking distance of me when I was living in Los Angeles. And I did, in those last few years that I was living in LA, find myself in those spaces more and more often. And so coming to live in the desert was just sort of an extension of that in a sense. And, you know,
I was kind of curious, and you mentioned a little bit about, you know, of course, what you can do in the city and what you can. And part of what intrigues me about your story is that was two things. One is that you were, even though you were going to the LA River and you were, there was always a sense of sensitivity to the forces of nature and that, whatever that means exactly, in Arthur and the kind of orientation that nonetheless, like the life you lived there, the things you supported were, you know, really about human culture, about the things that people were doing, bands, records, fashion moves. You know, it was a deeply, it really reflected a kind of deep urban experience. And then when you moved, it wasn't like, you know, there's a lot of people who moved to the desert and continued to do their work. They continued to be, right, you know, whatever, publishing or doing fashion shoots or recording records or, you know, really still kind of participating in that human cultural economy. And while you've done a little bit of that, in a lot of ways, you actually just kind of shifted and you were like, okay, I'm going to be here. How are we going to make a living? Okay, we're going to start working on, you know, turning cabins into places we can do, put on Airbnb, and we're going to start building our home. You know, you really went into the physical, local, logistical challenges of living there rather than just like having a kind of another sort of cultural life. So my question is, was your move out there partly also a personal shift in terms of the what your feelings, not judging others, but your feelings about the value of just more human culture, just like more people making more media and thinking and talking about more other media. You know, there's sort of something excessive about it. And it felt to me like that was also part of your move because you were so invested. You were so central to a lot of people, a lot of scenes that people were doing, that was a bigger shift than I think than some people who move out from the city.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I might give a little long answer here, but I think I'll be able to hit all your points.
Cool.
you know, Arthur, it was an urban thing mainly. I was living in L.A. The people that were working on it were in cities mainly across the United States and so on. We did have some things in the magazine, I think, that pointed the direction that I've headed personally in the years since the magazine ended, which was in 2008, I guess, or whenever it was. I revived it for a couple of issues, but that was sort of an after burp. The main thing was we had the Weed Eater column by Nance Clem, which was in Arthur, and we also had the New Herbalist column by Molly Francis, and we did that big article on the Compost King, the Sod Father, Tim Dundon, and we had your regular column, Eric, on the Analog Life, and we also had a column on skateboarding as sort of a mystical activity, and so on. So, you know, we had sort of these things in the magazine that kind of pointed into. The magazine was always trying to expand the range of approaches to art and to life that you could take and look at things at techniques that might work and might help folks to get on with what they're doing. And so we would, you know, we'd go into these, and sometimes we would say, yes, it's the try out meditation or try out or go for foraging and go for composting and try out this kind of psychedelic use, drug use, or try out this kind of spiritual tradition. These things were always, you know, part of the magazine. But yeah, it was still very much arts oriented and, you know, music oriented and so on. You know, as the years went on, Arthur started in 2002, ended, like I said, 2008 or so. I'd started, when we started Arthur, we thought that the arts sort of helped to direct where the culture goes, helped to direct where society goes. You know, there was that old Plato saying where, when the tone of the music changes, the city changes, something like that. And I really thought that, you know, that the arts provide sort of, you don't have an art dictatorship by artists, but you do have, they create the metaphors, they're the antenna of the race, they create the sort of, they frame things out that like eventually come into the mainstream culture. That in other words, that the bohemian culture is sort of the proto-culture, and that people have written about that before. So I thought, like, you know, you've got to keep the culture and the arts as vital as possible. And I tried to do the best I could in the years that I was at Arthur and other stuff before that, you know, at KBLT, at the radio station in L.A., the pirate radio station, or writing for the L.A. Weekly and so on. But I did think by the time we got to the mid-2000s that art, as much as I liked it and as much as important as it was to me, that art had now been overtaken by technology. It's not that technology had never been there before, but that this sort of technology was so disruptive and so ubiquitous and so all-powerful that the technology was now driving culture, and culture had sort of been put to the side. And then follow that on with the recession starting in 2007, 2008, and then lasting for a couple of years, when so many artists and record labels and book companies and careers just got destroyed or ended. And you know, Arthur and me, you know, we're kind of part of that. I definitely ran out of money, ran out of time, ran out of energy, and so on. And so, yeah, there was all of those things, this sort of fatigue with city urban life, hyper urban life, the sort of sense that maybe perhaps a life supporting the arts wasn't going to have the outcome that I hoped for, and that technology was here and it was the major moving force, and that I didn't like how that force was operating. That made me want to go in the opposite direction, and certainly headed out of the city as far as I could go in was a way for me to deal with all of that. And I got very fortunate, and that I ran into Stephanie, and yeah, we did try to figure out, like, okay, how can we make a living out here in a way that's in line with our ethics, and how can we build on it and hope to make a life that's worth living, you know, instead of just enduring urban life and then having the arts to sort of console you. You know, once you get out here, I don't know how much you really need art, you know, and that's the other thing that I sort of have learned through the years, and one of the reasons I'm not really involved in the arts anymore, in culture journalism or anything, is that fewer and fewer, I have less and less interest in art and more interest in the life, the nature that surrounds me, and then of course the inner life, which obviously deepens when you're in a zone like this.
Well, yeah, since you brought it up, mentioning the inner life, I mean, one of the things I was very happy to hear, you know, when I was get the occasional updates from you, is that you had the opportunity to practice with Ruth Dennison, who of all of the many marvelous characters who have lived in the Joshua Tree area, is perhaps my favorite, though I unfortunately never got to meet her or sit with her myself. And I think that was partly a time when you were also decided to get more into meditation. And that's one of our favorite topics here in Expanding Mind. So I'd love to talk, hear a little bit about your experience with her and how that helped sort of, how that helped kind of shift you into the mode that you're living in now.
Oh, yeah. This was a tremendous turning point for me and a tremendous good fortune. We lived out here for 2 years, and I decided I wanted to try to deepen my meditation practice, which basically didn't exist. And when I lived in L.A., I'd experimented with some Jewish meditation and then some Buddhist meditation, but without really any instruction, just a chance to sit with a monk who is in Koreatown, who is wonderful. But, you know, I didn't make a commitment there, and I didn't go very deep. When I was out here, there's a big spiritual contingent in the Joshua Tree area. There's a retreat center on the highway that's called the Institute of Mental Physics, and it's been around for decades. And a little bit, for me, a little bit kooky. But on the other hand, they often hosted good people including Stan Grof would be there, and Jack Kornfield and others. After being here a couple of years, I decided I should look into trying to get a meditation practice going. Who's doing meditation around here? We asked around to our various circles of friends that we'd made out here, and someone just said, well, Ruth Dennison, she's right up the road from you, and you've been over there, right? And I was like, that old woman. Who are you talking about? Ruth Dennison? Okay. It turned out, unbeknownst to me, that 2 miles up the dirt road from us was an 89-year-old, world-renowned Buddhist teacher named Ruth Dennison, who taught Vipassana, and she taught in the Theravadin tradition. She was born in East Germany, basically in Prussia, and grew up inside National Socialism, which she was into, and Christianity, which she was into, and she had a high school education, and then World War II occurred, and she realized she was on the wrong side, and she was also captured and inside, basically the Russians liberated from the East, and as they came in, they took prisoners and they treated women, including Ruth, as things happen in these horrible wars. And she somehow made it. I mean, there's a biography if people are really interested. There's a great biography by my friend Sandy Boucher. But basically what happened is Ruth made it from out of Germany to England and then eventually to Los Angeles, of all places, where she fell in with a spiritual seeker who was independently wealthy from a family fortune. And he used his wealth to host emissaries from the East and in the 50s and 60s at dinner parties and private retreats in the Los Angeles and the Hollywood area. And so Ruth was found herself in a world of that included people like Aldous Huxley and Alan Watts and Christopher Isherwood, and then also these various yogis and swamis and really significant teachers coming from the East, often coming to America for the first time, coming through their house, through their living room. Eventually, Ruth deepened her interest in this, and they went around the planet, and she ended up teaching at Esalen. She was at Millbrook during the when Leary was doing his thing there, and she learned lots of techniques, including the Vipassana technique from her Burmese teacher. When I met her, she had been in the desert since the 70s. She had the house in Hollywood, but she'd bought houses in Joshua Tree, and she started holding retreats there. She'd become a teacher in the early 70s, was given dispensation to teach in English and German in around the planet, and she was teaching on the West Coast mainly to women, and that was mainly who as well as to men, but her main. The main group she was teaching to were women. Often in the early 70s, in the mid 70s, they were feminists and groups of lesbians. And by the time I met her, she was 89. She died when she was 92, and I had about 1 year of going over to her zendo. And sitting in the morning every day for an hour, and sometimes Ruth would come into the zendo and talk and teach and instruct, and other times we would go walk around and do stuff. And we had about a year with her, and it was it really changed me in major ways. It made me it helped the usual things that probably people talk about with meditation, but essentially it gave me greater equanimity. It allowed me to release some of the craving and the grasping and that I was always had, and also I think it helped me deal with lingering sadness, bitterness, and depression about how my career had gone and how my life had gone and how Arthur had gone, which was my baby, Imagine, you know, how lucky could I get? You know, there are other people who would travel great distances to be with Ruth at her retreats or solo retreats, and I just happened to be in the neighborhood, and there she was. And then not only that, but it turned out that the tradition that Ruth taught from was also taught by Goenka, by S.N. Goenka, and there he founded Vipassana, a Vipassana movement, where the students essentially built their own centers all over the planet, and there's one in down the road in 29 Palms. So I can go to that one when I like to do a deep, intensive retreat somewhere other than at Ruth's place. So, yeah, I got very lucky. But, you know, I think the more you look around, if you look in rural areas, it's not everywhere, but there's a lot of spiritual teachers outside the cities. You know, a lot of retreats don't occur. They do occur in the cities, and they should, but they also occur out in the countryside, and there are monasteries. There are solo teachers. You know, as soon as I started looking around more, I realized, wow, there's a Zen center right up in Lucerne, you know, on the edge of Lucerne Valley. There's another one over there. There's another one over there. And so that's also reassuring to me, and I think it's good for folks to know, urban folks, like when you move out of the urban environment, it doesn't mean that you move away from perhaps some of these spiritual institutions or centers that have been of help to you there, that they also exist, not everywhere, of course, but they do exist in rural areas in the countryside as well. And in some ways, it can be, perhaps, if for some people, it can be a deeper experience to have that kind of practice or to have that kind of instruction in that kind of environment.
Makes sense. You know, it was very clear to me, I mean, talking to you over the years and seeing how you changed and talked about, you know, pulling out of the difficulties of the of the demise of Arthur and disappointment and all that, that the meditation was a really important part of it. But it was also, it seemed to me that it also had to do with just the fact that living out there and deciding to, you know, restore old homestead cabins and you know, turn them into properties and to work on farming and work in your place, that all of that activity, that doing, that practice, and it's a lot of, that's another huge part of it is just putting yourself in a situation where life itself demands that you develop skills, capacities, patience, endurance, cleverness, and social connections that enable you to do all the things now that you want to do. And I'm curious, like, how difficult was that for you? I mean, if you don't have the background, if you're not raised in a rural environment, if you don't have like super handy parents who teach you how to do, there's a lot of stuff I don't know how to do. I'm a clever guy, I can use my hands, but this is a lot of stuff I just don't know how to do, and it sort of seems overwhelming sometimes. Oh my God, if I was living out there, all these things I don't know how to do. What was your experience about developing competence and how that worked with the community and with your own sort of discovery process?
Oh, that's a really good point. You know, I didn't know much. I didn't know hardly anything, and I still know very little. Stephanie knows a lot more than I do. And but yes, when we moved in together in her, she had a small house and then next door a little cabin. We didn't know much. One of the first things was, there are snakes out here. Snakes have always been like the, I wasn't scared of snakes my whole life. Like a snake is like the worst case scenario for me. And so, and then we heard that, you know, there were poisonous snakes, you know, rattlesnakes, you know. So every time we witnessed a snake, it was like, when we were first living together, it was like terror, panic. What is that snake? Is it coming? Is it going to get inside? Where is it now? Who is it? And so what I would do is we would try to take a photograph of a snake that's, you know, a few feet from you and then run away. and then send and then email the photograph to a friend or whatever and say, who knows more than you do, and say, is that a rattlesnake? Now what do I do? And that was how we were learning things. It was really not doing a very good job, wasn't very efficient. So what I did was we started a blog. It seemed like the easiest way to show, basically to find out what snakes we had living around us. I would put a photo of the snake on the blog, and then I would send, I'd ask a bunch of people at once rather than sending it independently to all these different people. And then people would say, oh, that's a red racer. Those guys act like this, doodle, doodle, doo. And then I'd go and I need to know more. I'd get the book on snakes. I would find the website of a guy that had, knew everything about the desert and learn from that. And gradually, by learning more about each thing that presented itself, became at ease with it and began to actually enjoy that, to the point now where a snake encounter is kind of pleasant and interesting to me now. But yeah, we had to, basically I had to be really, just be really upfront and humble and say, this person who in the city, I felt like I was pretty competent and I could handle most things and I knew, and I was resourceful. Out here, I had to find new resources. And I felt the idea was to find the people who know stuff and then hang out with them.
Yeah, there's a passage. You wrote an article called Letter from North Joshua Tree from the Desert Oracle, which is a wonderful zine publication that comes out of that area, and is definitely really a marvelous mixture of weirdness and biology and has a real sense of place. I really love the publication. But you have this great line. You go, or a lot couple lines. It goes, you say, see, it's easy to get back to the land when there's already a few people there. They show you how to live wisely in the place where you are, what trees can stand gray water, why you should get a swamp cooler instead of a standard AC, what month you need to wrap the water pipes, how you need to let the coyotes have a place to get water so they don't chew your overground irrigation lines. We neglected the coyotes, and now we have a couple water fountains flowing near our jujube tree orchard every time we turn on the water at our farm. And what I loved about that little phrase is not just a reminder of all the things that you got to do, the competencies that you have to sort of move into, but how social it is. That part of the, you think about, oh, you can move into the desert, you're homesteading, it's about, being alone, it's about being self-sufficiency, self-reliance. It's like, well, yeah, it's true, but it's also about finding new ways and new reasons for community. And I know the community was always such an important part of what Arthur was about and what you were supporting as an arts journalist and as an editor. I'd like to hear about how community sensibility has flowered for you out there with the other, with, different demands, different environments, different situation.
Yeah, that's right. Like you're saying, you don't have to start from scratch. You just have to be open to admitting ignorance and to be persistent in trying to find someone who knows what you need to know. And so we gradually found those things. And, yeah, we fell into different parts of the communities at different times. Like when we were in 2010, 2011, everyone was broke out here. We all had a lot of time on our hands, and we needed stuff done. So we... Stephanie formed a sort of a bartering group where we would, not so much a formal bartering, but more of a barn raising group where we would, someone would have a project, a physical, well, let's build this, let's build that, but they can't afford to pay people, so it never gets done. Well, we'll come over and I'll build it that day, and then you come over and build my thing next week, and then I'll go and build someone else's thing 2 weeks later. And it becomes an old idea, barn raising. Nothing new there. It's just so we did some of that for a little while. There's also the Mojave Desert, like I said, the Mojave Desert Land Trust, which we've gotten more involved in. We started a pilot program with them, where basically Stephanie and I realized that we had a successful. I guess maybe I should tell the listeners what we do out here. What happened was, Stephanie's an architectural designer, and we were able to convert one of her, she had an old homesteader cabin. Most of the properties out in the area of Joshua Tree that we live in, they're 5-acre parcels, or sometimes 2.5 acres, but they were, all these structures were built in the 30s, 40s, and 50s when the government was essentially giving away land to anyone who said they would homestead on it. And homesteading meant that they would build a structure of a certain minimum size, and then they would occupy it a certain amount of the time of the year. And then they could have the land basically for free. And so what you have across the landscape up here in North Joshua Tree and other parts of the high desert are all these 5-acre parcels with 400-square-foot cabins. Some of them have water, some of them have electricity, some of them don't have either. When we were living here, and Stephanie bought her first cabin in 2002 when she was living in L.A., and she bought a cabin out here in 2002. And then by the time we were out here in 2010, there were empty cabins everywhere. Most of them had been, when a cabin's empty out in this area, if that is empty meaning no one's living there, it was getting squatted by meth people, by tweakers, or it would get shot up by people with, you know, guns on the weekends just shooting targets, or it would be overrun by people driving their horrible, you know, little off-road vehicles and motorcycles and so on. And so the environment was sort of being trashed by folks who live out here and people who come out here to do exactly that. So what we did was we took Stephanie's cabin and made it into sort of, it's almost an eco-tourist destination in some way. You come out to the cabin, we use the Airbnb platform, you stay there, and you have a sort of homesteader experience. There's a compost toilet, there is internet access, but basically you're in unfenced land in the rural wilderness, and you get to stay there. And by your being there, that is you, the guest, you keep that, you're sort of the guardian of that space just by being yourself, just by sitting there on the porch or by having parked in your car, just doing, you know, eating food, whatever you're doing. You don't have to, you're not out there with a gun or anything. But just by being there, what you do is you keep the place from being trashed by others. And then, of course, we get income from it, which we used to buy another cabin. And then we got another one. And suddenly we ended up, because the cabins were so cheap, because this was in the deepest, deepest part of the recession, and things were literally a few thousand dollars each, and if you could get that cash together, you could get a place. We ended up with a number of properties, and on which we would try to steward them. We found out from the Mojave Desert Land Trust that the land that we occupy, these various cabins around a couple mile range, is inside a wildlife corridor that they're trying to establish and enrich. That is, this is supposed to be a place where the animals and plants, as species, can move as climate change occurs. And without, you know, and so the idea was, well, let's try and take each of our properties so that it's part, it contributes to that corridor rather than takes away from it. So let's get rid of no fences, and let's put in, if we're going to have if we're going to be using water there, let's use the for a sink or for a shower, let's use it for gray water. Let's use the gray water to grow native plants, and so on. As we did this, though, we sort of reached our limits. Like we got up to 7 properties. And it's hard to, we couldn't manage anymore, you know, and it's not like, oh, woe is us. It was more like, that's as much as we can do. But there's other properties around here that we wish we could own and steward it with this ethic, but it's beyond our means. So our idea was to get with the land trust and to help us find our neighbors around in this area who also have the same, if you approach them about it, would have the same ethic or the same interest. Like, how can they change or transform or better use their properties, whatever they are, 2.5 acres, 5 acres, an acre and a quarter, to be a sort of a better part of this wildlife corridor? And we've got now a group of about 75 people. We call ourselves the stewards of the Coyote Valley. It's a little, you know, this is a, we can call this area Coyote Valley if you want to. And it's a little aspirational in one sense. I mean, we definitely aren't like full-time stewards, but it's a thing that more and more people are attracted to in this area, and then people who move here are also becoming involved in this. And it's that's been a really wonderful, the deepest way, I think, of living here for us is to be a part of something, and this goes back to like why it wasn't so much fun to be in the urban area. In the urban areas, I felt like there was no space in which I could, there wasn't much space where I could make a real lasting positive difference, and that got me down. And here, I feel like, yeah, I can, maybe I'm not doing much on the cultural front or whatever, but on those 2 acres, like, those 2 acres aren't being trashed. Those 2 acres have more trees on them. Those 2 acres have more animals on them. Those 2 acres have monarch butterflies flying through now that didn't fly through before. And that's not just like, oh, good job, me and Stephanie. It's more of like, it's really great and awesome just to be there amongst them in a sort of garden in the desert. And you know, this is not a unique thing that only a few people are going to feel. This is almost a universal feeling. I mean, people come out here to be in nature. They come out here when there's a wildflower explosion like there's going on right now, and everyone is into it. You don't have people coming out here and getting disappointed, oh, I didn't like the wildflowers. You know, I was thinking, Eric, you know Sturgeon's Law?
I don't remember.
You know, it's Sturgeon's Law, which was like, he was a science fiction writer, and he someone complained to him once, like, oh, but, you know, science fiction, like 90% of it is crap. And he said, well, yeah, 90% of science fiction is crap, but 90% of everything is crap.
Right.
And that's Sturgeon's Law. Well, that's true maybe about human culture, but that's not true about nature. Absolutely not. I'll tell you, 90% of monarchs, no, are not crap. 100% of monarch butterflies are awesome. 100% of wildflowers are awesome. There are horrible things that happen in nature. There's a lot of deaths. There's a lot of parasites and horrible things happen. You see rabbits getting torn apart by coyotes and so on and so forth. But that's not horrible in the way that like horrible human culture is. And I just keep coming back to that over and over. And that's why, you know, you can be here outside of it. I lived in LA for, like I said, 20 years. I've been to LA one night in the last 4 years total. You know, I do not miss it, and I miss my friends there and so on. But it's like this, as a friend said to me once, he's the sound manager, sound guy for the Queens of the Stone Age, tours all over the planet, lives here in Joshua Tree. And one time he looked at me and just goes, it never gets boring here, does it? And he's right. I cannot get enough of this place.
So listen, we got about 8 minutes left, and I have admittedly bigger question, but I just want to touch on it in our remaining time. You talked just there about, you know, making connections with locals, with people, and then also the problems with some of the people who live out there in terms of trashing the place and whatever. You know, as I don't need to tell you, the United States is in an extraordinarily polarized time right now. One of the comforts of urban life, at least in a lot of areas, is that you're more or less surrounded by people who have more or less your kind of general political outlook. Whereas you go out into the rural area and suddenly there's a lot of Trump country very conservative people who, and their conservatism partly is about where they live and both their experiences with political problems and ecological problems, but also a certain kind of spirit, if you will, that animates American rural areas. How has being there given you a different outlook, a different angle on this kind of polarization in the country that's different, let's say, than someone who's looking at it from an urban perspective, when it's always those people over there have those backwards ideas. Well, now you're living with people who might have ideas that are different than you, some of which you don't agree with, or behaviors you don't agree with. But in the other way, and on the other hand, you're thrown together in different ways, I can only imagine. So I'd love to hear if you have anything to say about that.
That's true. And you know, out here, Joshua Tree is sort of a liberal enclave. Not everyone in Joshua Tree is a progressive political person, but we are surrounded. I'll put it this way. The next town over is the home of a Marine base, 29 Palms. And then the other town over, Yucca Valley, is a very conservative area, pro-development. They want to be a suburb. And that's definitely Trump country. I think there are definitely Trump voters and so on in our area. But, you know, in the neighborhood, you get down to some pretty simple things like working with your neighbors to make sure that the road is passable, alerting each other if there's a fire at someone's house, talking with each other about who's going to help with the food distribution for the poorest folks in the area. And one thing I see out here a lot is that a lot of the more conservative people, or the more conservative, I won't even say conservative, the more reactionary folks and the Trump voter folks, is a lot of them are in enclaves where the smart folks have left. They've sort of been abandoned, these areas. The smart kids went to school and then went to big cities and didn't come back. And so they have no one who really... they're missing that part. You know, you don't want to have a society of only smart people, but you also need to have some smart people around, or some learned people, or however you want to put it, some people who are adept in some things. And if you don't have that there, then I think places do just sort of devolve and go backwards, and that's what you're seeing. Really, it's really that simple. There has been a brain drain from the rural areas and from the countryside into the cities. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't smart folks out in these places and wise folks and so on. There certainly are, and you can find them pretty quickly, but they're around. But generally speaking, what's happened is that the smarter folks are gone, and these poor people just don't know what's going on. They don't know what to read. They don't know how to think about things. No one talks to them in a language that they understand. No one answers the burning questions that they have in a way that makes sense to them. And so they just go along with whatever's on the radio. And, you know, and what's on the radio is talk radio. Most of the time isn't Progressive Radio Network, but it's, you know, it's out here. It's like Rush Limbaugh, like from one end of the spectrum to the other. And so, yeah, you're going to get a devolved politically speaking, you're getting a devolved situation if that's what people are being exposed to all the time and the smart folks are getting out. I think most of these folks, if you just hang out, you have to hang out with them a lot, earn their trust, and then you just try to do your thing as best as you can and be a model for a different way of being, and that's about the best you can do. And, you know, you can't be the... One of the things about being out here is you can have all these grandiose ideas like, I'm going to be the person that transforms this area. No, you're not. You're going to be a person out here who hopefully makes a difference in whatever land you have and finds the others, hopefully, and works with them to make the best of your time here on this land, on this planet. I mean, and isn't that the job, you know, of life itself? So live to build the garden and then live and enjoy it. So you have a good chance out here. I don't see that you have that good a chance in urban areas, which is, you know, which is why I think people in urban areas often dream about coming out here.
Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense. We just got a couple minutes left. I'm just kind of curious, What's on deck in your garden now? What are you working on? What's calling your heart in terms of your own plot of paradise?
Well, Stephanie started a we bought a at a tax auction, so a way to buy property very cheap. A couple years ago, there was some people had tried to do a farm of Asian pear trees out here in the desert, and they failed, and then they gave it up, and we bought the place. You know, they'd scraped the land of all the natives and tried to do something that would never have worked. And so what Stephanie has done is she volunteered at the national park. They have a nursery there to help replant and reforest parts of the parks, and she learned what plants they grow for the park and how and what techniques they used. And now she's applying those ideas to that 20-acre abandoned farm that we bought. And she's growing all sorts of plants, bushes, trees, shrubs that are drought-tolerant, that provide food, medicine, or shelter, and can survive on very little water and in a dry, in an arid and sometimes windy environment. So she's growing all sorts of stuff there. The jujube, yes, we have jujube trees that have survived. Those are the only trees the former people planted that worked. And she's got tons and tons of stuff. People can look it up at Sunever Farms. If you look up Sunever Farms on the internet, she's on Instagram. Stephanie's on the got a website. You can see what she's growing. Here at our home, we've got a little vegetable gardens growing. I'm trying to grow some Texas early grano onion, some tarahumara squash, some chimeo melon, some gray zucchini squash, and some other stuff. All that we've purchased from Native Seed Search in I think in Tucson, which is a similar altitude to us and some similar weather. So we're trying out different kinds of things that might work here. Here on this little homestead.
Well, that's great, Jay. Also, I want to let people know that if they're interested in checking out one of the marvelous little zones you got for temporary homesteading, you can go to jthomesteader.com and look at some of the places you guys rent and find out a little bit more about you. But we're going to have to wrap it up there. So, Jay, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thanks, Eric. I hope I was coherent enough and not babbling too much. And I really appreciate you getting to talk about this stuff with you. It's wonderful. I'm so glad your radio show is such a success and has been going for so many years now. Amazing. Good work, Eric.
Well, thanks a lot, Jay. I really appreciate it. So good luck to you as well. All right, folks, till next week, keep your minds open.